Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
I brought a library's worth today, just so you can see this argumentation. Yeah, it goes back to really childish stuff, to major devotional commentaries. I think the first one of these books that I got was back in the mid-70s. These are books about science and faith and how they mix, how it works together. This was an ichthyologist who wrote this. You know what an ichthyologist would be? He's a fish scientist. That's right, ichthys. And he wrote the book Evolution, the Fossils Say No. Henry Morris wrote the main book. He was the main man of this mob called the creation science research people. Henry Morris, lots of other people, all PhDs, all in science, all pretty prestigious, smart people. But these were from the 70s and 80s. And then last year, Forerunners of Darwin, this book came out last year. It's by Francis Collins, called The Language of God. And it is not on the same ilk, not on the same level, but in the same genre that is trying to blend science and religion. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But tonight we're going to continue, as we've seen, Tim Keller continues to address objections raised by significant people, and this week is no exception. These include preaching atheists like Richard Dawkins, every good atheist's hero, Daniel Dennett, and Christopher Hitchens. He's been on the ABC I don't know how many times. For with his reasoned defense of faith, Keller challenges the scientific prosecutors of doubt on their own ground. One by one, his arguments for unbelief fall in light of his own logic. The claim that science has disproved religion comes in for particular scrutiny as Keller deflects the anti-religion that converts evolutionary theory into an obituary for religious orthodoxy. One of Keller's most provocative arguments is that all doubts, however skeptical and cynical they may seem, are really a set of alternate beliefs. This is huge. You've got to get this. When somebody avers another viewpoint, they are merely espousing another set of beliefs, which are not science. They're merely philosophy or religion or whatever you want to say. I have used the word scientism before to coin this into perspective. Scientism, in my understanding, is the belief that science has all knowledge and nothing is explicable without science. That is, science, which means knowledge, that's what the word means, Latin, is the end all of every bit of information that's out there. Therefore, if you come to me with something that's knowledgeable and it doesn't fit my paradigm or my thought process or worldview called science, then it's wrong. Dawkins, Dennett, and even Sam Harris, if you're up on all the science versus religion debates, these names have surfaced several times for you. Here's the heart of the question. This chapter, chapter 6, science has disproved Christianity. That's the title of the chapter tonight. Here's the heart of the question this chapter poses, and Keller seeks to answer. Has science essentially disproven Christian beliefs? Or to put it another way, must we choose between thinking scientifically and a belief in God? Keller answers no to both of these. You would hope that I would say that. Aren't miracles scientifically impossible? Think about that. Science explains natural things. So when the Jewish people walked through the Red Sea on dry land, which moments before had been wet, and moments after was wet again to flush out and flood and overwhelm Pharaoh's army, that's called a miracle. Science cannot explain it. The Jewish people were birthed out of impossibility, literally birthed. What am I thinking? Abraham had a baby. Not many 100-year-olds in the neighborhood are having kids. No, none. Not many 90-year-old women to whom they're married are having kids. The birth of the baby, Isaac, was a miracle. It's scientifically explicable in a way, but it's out of bounds for science. You'd say his old sperm and her old eggs are too rusty and crusty and it ain't gonna happen, and it happened. So did it happen? Yeah, that's the text. That's what we as Jews have believed. That's what all faithful believers, whether Christian or Jews, have held on to. So we have to then say, are miracles, which by definition are supernatural, super meaning above, or extraordinary, which means outside of the ordinary, Once we say there can be a miracle, then science will necessarily scratch its head and say, I don't get it. That's almost a definition. That's the way it works. Are miracles scientifically impossible? Behind this question is an assumption that science makes no faith claims of its own, that its presumptions are fair and judicious, that it is science after all. Keller refers to, this is a great story, Alvin Plantinga, scientist himself and philosopher, a brilliant Dutchman. Plantinga's critiquing Macquarie, who is a philosophic, supernatural knocker. He's a philosopher, scientifically based. Macquarie is right in saying that science must always assume there's a natural cause, because really that's the only cause that scientific methods are able to measure and prove. Remember, we've heard the phrase, the scientific method. Remember what that starts with? Scientists? Anybody? Hypothesis. Starts with an idea and you say, I wonder if I drop this glass on the floor, I hypothesize that the water that's within it will stay within it. It won't splash. That's my hypothesis. Not a scientific study yet. I have to run tests on it. I have to do this not once. I have to do this a goodly number of times. And once I've done that, then I evaluate. That's what science is. I evaluate my experiments in light of my hypothesis and draw a conclusion. That's pretty much the scientific method. In light of that, can we even ever deal with creation as science? We start with an hypothesis and we run exams. We test it. Where could we possibly test creation from nothing?
By looking at the heavens.
We could look at it, but the things are already there. How can we ever prove scientifically, by the scientific method that everyone agrees is the scientific method, how can we ever prove whether God created the world or it just happened? It requires repeatability. And there's no repeatability out of creation from nothing, because once you've done that, there's something. Quite a thing to insist that science has proven that there can't be any other kind of knowledge. In a metaphorically colorful way, Plantinga responds that Macquarie's argument amounts to a drunk doing something. Let me read it to you. It's really fun. Macquarie meant to suggest that the very practice of science requires that one reject the idea, for instance, of God raising someone from the dead. This argument is like the drunk who insisted on looking for his lost car keys only under the streetlight, on the grounds that the light was better there. In fact, it would go the drunk one better. It would insist that because the keys would be hard to find in the dark, they must be under the light. That is a pretty clever argument. That's the only place he can see, therefore they must be there. And those of you who've lost keys or anything else know that's not the way it works. They're always in the last place you look. Should just start there. Isn't science in conflict with Christianity? That's one of his big heads. And remember, Keller is a pastor and a thinking pastor and a kind Presbyterian in New York City. And he's dealing with people who are really thoughtful people who attend his church, who fall out on all kinds of this argument that these books represent. The question is a culturally plausible one to raise. After all, how many of us have witnessed the ugly battles back and forth between creationists, represented in those books, and evolutionists? You'll see that every now and again on the ABC or on other science programs, Discovery, History Channel. You go into the Natural History Museum, and what's the first thing you're met with? Some dinosaur that's 50 million years old. And the scientific creationists are saying, like the Orthodox Jews, no, it's 5,700 and change years ago. Well, wait a minute, how can it be 6,000 years old when science proves that it's billions or millions of years old? The arguments, as much as the contention itself, have soured in many of our ears. Keller provides a third way, not one he invented to be sure, compare Warfield. Since this is one of Keller's main points that needs careful listening, I'm going to quote him. Christians may believe in evolution as a process without believing in philosophical naturalism. Let me define that, and then I'll go on with more of Keller. The view that everything has a natural cause and that organic life is solely the product of random forces guided by no one. That's how he defines philosophical naturalism. I know this is a little different than turn with me in your Bible to Romans chapter 4, but I want you to get this because you're going to bang up against this regularly from now on, if not already. When evolution is turned into an all-encompassing theory explaining absolutely everything we believe, feel, and do as the product of natural selection, then we're not in the area of science, but of philosophy, Ken Keller says, I would add, religion. because science can only explain what it can explain, it leaves out some things. And Keller says, when you leave out things and you argue that it's science, then really it's not science but philosophy. And it's okay. People can be philosophical. People can have faith, religion, if you will, in whatever they want, but be honest about what it is. It's not science. Science is when you pour the two chemicals, the two liquids together, stir it up, and it's going to do that every time. But everything else before science is faith. That's why it's called the theory of evolution, not the fact of evolution. Now, the boys up north, the Creation Ministries people, and we have some of their books in our sales section, the Creation Ministry, Jonathan Sarfati, who moved to Florida, and I'm really sad about that. He's a Jewish believer who grew up in New Zealand, and he lived up in Brizzy for a while. Now he's moved to Florida last year. He's about 40. He was a chess champion, international chess champion. He wrote the books Refuting Evolution 1 and 2. I listen to him and say, what the heck did he just say? I mean, he's a lot of fun, but I don't get it. A whole lot of what he says. So I reread, I go back over. So Sarfati's mob up in Brisbane has written this about Keller and his theistic evolution. Maybe you missed it when I said it. There are scientists who say there is no God and everything's done by evolution. There are Christians who say God did it all, 6 days, that's it, Schengenich. He didn't have to do anything else, 6 days, and spoke, and it was, that's it. And then Keller represents kind of a middle ground, that's part of his personality anyway, of theistic evolution. That is, God started processes, and God did it. He's not an arguer for just random science or no agents ever created us, but God initiated things. And then the scientific processes kick in. Now, the boys up north don't like that. Keller's incomplete answer to the question of pain and suffering, that was from an earlier chapter, was an error of omission. But this chapter on science and religion contains many errors of commission. He handles the issue of miracles versus science well, but he cites the predictable theistic evolutionist line on the Bible and evolution. He asserts that Genesis 1 is a poem, and the Genesis 2 is the history. He compares it to Judges 4 and 5. In Judges 4, we have this battle. We get Deborah. We get Sisera. And in chapter 5, Deborah's song. The song of Deborah is absolutely gorgeous. And it's a poem. And it's a common device to mix poetry and history in Jewish story, to mix in a poem in the midst of it. It's a repetition. Iliad, Shakespeare did that a bunch. I'll just say this, let it bypass you if it's too much, but for the people listening online, if you like this stuff, you might really enjoy this. His claim is centered around the presence of prose poetry couplets in the Bible, such as the historic account of Deborah's victory over Sisera in Judges 4, followed by the Song of Deborah in chapter 5, in poetic form. But Keller appears to make a mistake or not be aware about the linguistic characteristics of Hebrew poetry and history. Poetry contains parallelism, while history is dominated by particular verb forms known as preterites or vav consecutives. A statistical analysis by Hebrew scholar Stephen Boyd showed that perfect and imperfect verbs are dominant in undoubted poetic passages, like Judges 5, while preterites dominate in undoubted historical narrative, like Judges 4. And his analysis showed the probability that Genesis 1 is a narrative is 0.999999. It's almost for real. Its verb predominance was just like a passage that Keller agrees is historical. Keller affirms that God did not originally make the world to have disease, hunger, and death in it. We could say after this week, earthquakes, tsunamis. That's not God's original plan. However, according to Keller's long-age evolutionary interpretation, disease, hunger, and death were around from the beginning. So you can bet the creationists don't like that. He misses the fall. Basically, Keller doesn't address the fall of humankind. The original sin, which was whose sin? Adam and Eve. Everybody wants to choose their favorite.
It's
the serpent, the snake. Well, there were four characters, and three of them didn't turn out very well in Genesis 3. God alone was pretty good and lived happily ever after, but Adam, Eve, and the serpent all went to their appropriate cursedness. And the ground was cursed as well. And that means the earth, or we would say the tillable land, all that was cursed, and fell under the curse of God. God's original plan was blessedness, and curse came on the earth. Sweat of your brow, Adam, pain in childbirth, Eve, serpent, you're going to crawl on your belly, and it's not going to be a happy day for you. All this came out as a result of Adam's sin. One man's transgression brought ruin and death to the world. Keller doesn't really go into that. I found when I read the creationists' review of chapter 6, I was very pleased to read their interpretation because I'd missed that. I found Keller so good that I'd missed that, I think, pretty fundamental point. No, I don't think there were earthquakes before the fall. There would have been no tsunami. Some of you who've been around for a while know that I believe that the earth used to be one landmass. One single landmass. We don't have to be very scientific to note South America fits into Africa, or that North America and Europe, it all fits. It would have fit together. But they say to me, interesting, Tassie and South Australia fit more in India than Darwin, which would have been south. That is, the landmass we call Australia actually rotated 180 degrees, which makes sense in a flood when everything goes wacky. Look at the tsunami. Try to find your car. Try to find your uncle. Try to find your house. And those things were washed in one 10-meter flood, one quick 10-meter flood. And it only lasted for how long? Not very. Noah's flood was 40 days and 40 nights of serious rain. And the flood that ensued was global and crushed and pushed and separated the continents. And they are still separating. The plates are moving. It's called plate tectonics. And the plates are moving. And they say that these earthquakes that we've seen in the world in the last year are all related to the same plate. And think of it like a rectangle. Chile and Christchurch, Japan, and they say there'll be one in California because they come in clusters. I don't doubt that at all, because that single plate is moving around. The flood caused the separation of continents. Predictably, Keller does not deal with the fact that the rest of the Bible takes Genesis as a historical narrative, and so did nearly all Christian commentators for most of the history of Christendom. Keller asserts that belief in evolution does not necessarily lead to materialistic philosophy, but he doesn't offer any actual evidence to back up his statement, and he also seems blissfully unaware, their words, not mine, of the problems regarding death and suffering before the fall in any long-age system. His rationalization that skeptics, quote, should not allow themselves to be distracted by this intramural debate, end quote, and that they should concentrate on weightier central claims of Christianity seems rather naive, considering that the creation-evolution issue has been of central importance to a load of people, and some have apostatized when they've ceased to believe it. Interestingly, at the end of his chapter, Keller affirms that, quote, God did not originally make the world to have disease, hunger, and death in it. However, according to Keller's long-age evolutionary interpretation, disease, hunger, and death were around from the beginning. Biblical people know that the fall of man is the crux. It happens right away. Genesis 3, it happens right away in the beginning of the Bible. And the rest of the Bible is given to how are we going to get back with God. It's really what it is. Adam and Eve were walking with God. It was lovely, good time. And then we fell. And the rest of the Bible is the description of man's inhumanity towards himself, towards other men, his attempts to make right with God by religion or philosophy or something, and God's ever-reaching desire to be part and parcel of our lives. That's the story of the Bible.
But why would a loving God know beforehand that if he created Adam and Eve the way he would, that they would fall into sin, and therefore they would be cursed and the ground would be cursed? Why did he do that when he knew they were going to fall into sin anyway?
Free will. But the question Ezra's asking is deeper than that. Not how was it that we fell, but since God is omniscient, knows
exactly
everything, how was it that he went ahead and did it, knowing the result?
That's right. That's my question. He knew they were going to go wrong. Why did he tell Adam, listen, Adam, that tree is there. I tell you what you do. Build a hedge around it. Put all the stairs and all that. Make sure you don't go there at all. Or put a fire around it or something. And make sure you don't go there at all. He could have given some advice or guidance. Yeah.
Right, he said don't. So Ezra's point is, why doesn't he build a big hedge around it?
Yeah.
Why doesn't he put flaming guards there then? Because he wants people to really love him. Willing obedience,
yeah, that's
it. How many alcoholics still find a way to get alcohol into their closets and drink?
And drugs.
You know, they've built systems. They're sponsored by this AA person or NA person. They've got all these setups to prevent that kind of thing. And they, yeah, well, just still have a little nip. man's functional relationship with God needs to be of his own free will. My kids are wonderful. I've got the three best kids on the planet. Well, this father says that. I love my kids, and the greatest thing is when they, of their own free will, give me a call. Hey, Pop, how's it going? As a daddy, there's nothing like relationship that is free will. You know, when a baby is a baby and you get them to coo or you get them to smile, oh, look, you know, little Menachem, he's smiling. You say, oh, look, he's smiling. You know it's gas. But you're just making them do what you want them to do at that point. Wait till Menachem gets to be 14 and he's hanging around with puppies who aren't so kind to you or to their parents. And then when Menachem does a smile at you, man, that is the best thing. That's free will. And that's how love is really known. That's what God really has always wanted, relationship. There are basically four options that science and religion can take in relation to one another. Keller lays these out pretty well. Conflict, dialogue, integration, and independence. Conflict, dialogue, integration, and independence. Keller, in my opinion, takes an integration and dialogue approach to science and religion, and he's not alone in this. Stephen Jay Gould himself disagrees with Dawkins because he doesn't believe that science is able to account for everything. So instead of thinking about Christianity in conflict with science, rather consider that all four of the relationships might manifest themselves depending on which form of Christianity may be engaging which form of science. That is, a fundamentalist literalism will have a much more conflict-natured relation to those who are in concert with Dawkins, while a post-conservative or progressive form of Christianity would have a dialogical relation with people like Gould on certain points. Doesn't evolution disprove the Bible? That's a big... Keller acknowledges that there are several approaches both to the genre and interpretation of Genesis 1, as well as to the way evolution might be engaged. Therefore, he says this, quote, since Christian believers occupy different positions on both the meaning of Genesis 1 and on the nature of evolution, those who are considering Christianity as a whole should not allow themselves to be distracted by this intramural debate, end quote. And just so you know where Keller comes down, he actually says, I think God guided some kind of process of natural selection, and yet I reject the concept of evolution as an all-encompassing theory. If the Bible is true, and if Yeshua is the Messiah, the Bible continues to call to our attention God as the first way we know him, creator, throughout the record of the Older and Newer Testament. If he's not that, then the whole Bible is sus. Yeshua said that. He cited Genesis as an historical record. He didn't cite it as a book of poetry. He didn't cite it as an interesting legend or folklore. He cited it as history. Did not God say, a man shall leave his father and mother and join his father? I mean, that's right there. Since the beginning, it's not so, for a man shall leave father and mother. You get Yeshua commenting on this. But look, doubts happen. Doubts rise. There's nothing wrong with doubts. I'm not trying to solicit any, but it's good when you doubt things that you've been brainwashed to believe. When you doubt the theory of evolution, that's good. Then look at it for what it is, which is a theory, and look at it against the measurement of the rest of science. Problem is, a lot of people will mock you. You religionists, you're all so closed-minded. You're all so ignorant. Don't you know there's not one scientist out there who believes like you? Well, I don't know. There's not one. You're right. There are whole societies of PhDs, ichthyologists, and others who happen to believe, like we do, that the Bible's true, that God created the world in 6 days. My shock is not why did it take him such a short time, but why did it take him such a long time to create the world? 6 days? He spoke, and it was. That, and then you're tired? Let there be, and there was, and he took the whole day off. Come on, get the whole thing done, you know, get some efficiency going. But he took 6 different days to speak a thing, and it was. I love that about God. Very careful to attention, very careful to particulars, and beautiful, beautiful. Love. Keller's quick to note that miracles are hard to believe. Miracles are hard. We understand that. How many of us have seen resurrections? Dead people, dead for 2 days, dead for 4 days, come back to life. Any of us? No. I'm talking about clinically dead, recorded as dead by a scientist, that is a doctor or a nurse. And they happen, and we've heard of stories like that, but they're few and far between. There's no way to scientifically explain them.
There's a lot of near-death. And many people, when they come back, they say that they don't want to be there after they experience wherever they go.
Fascinated by those. Science cannot explain them. They can say, I saw some electrodes happening on this side of your brain, but they can't explain what the person has seen. They can't explain what the person has experienced. Can miracles actually take place? Of course they can. You know, Yeshua said it in Matthew 28. These are Yeshua's last words in this biography written by his friend Matthew, who was a tax collector and a Jew who had a questionable life in relation to other Jewish people, but who came through and had a marvelous rest of his life because Yeshua changed him. The disciples were there in Galilee. They'd been designated to be there. Yeshua meets with them, and then he literally flies away. That's the end. And it says that some worshipped him, but some were doubtful. When they saw him, some worshipped. You know, there's no character in the Bible who receives worship but God. There are others who bow down to, say, Peter the Apostle. And Peter says, get up, get up. I'm just like you. Paul receives this kind of adoration. And he says, get up. I'm just like you. Put on my socks the same or sandals the same way you do. But Yeshua ever received it because he knew who he was. And when they knew who he was as God on earth, it all made sense. But some doubted. Some doubted. How would you like that as a testimony to you in the record of Scripture? Matthew, why'd you write that about us? We were the doubters. You know, there's doubting Thomas, who shows up in John's account. There might be others. They had just experienced the resurrection. Yeshua had died. They'd seen him die. He was in the tomb. They watched that happen. They watched blood and water come out of his side, which is asphyxiated, which means he's gone. He's dead. They wept. They wrapped him. They put him in the tomb. They sealed the tomb. He was dyingly dead. And then, just a few days later, he's up. He's around. He's having lunch with them. He's talking. He's teaching them. And 40 days on now, just before Shavuot, he leaves. But some doubt it. Some doubt it. Miracles themselves don't prove anything anyone. But they afford you the opportunity to believe. It is designed to clash with a scientistic, remember my word, a scientistic viewpoint that science is the conclusive explanation of all things. Miracles are designed to shake you out of that. They don't necessarily do so. Hence, this guy who's now a preacher may be a result of a serious God doing, but this guy from the casket may not be. Because miracles don't make anybody do anything. Yeshua healed people. Peter walked on water, and Judas was right there and still wasn't changed in his heart. Miracles don't make anybody believe. It just affords us the opportunity to see things from God's point of view. We modern people think of miracles as the suspension of the natural order. Yeshua meant them to be the restoration of the natural order. The Bible tells us that God did not originally make the world to have disease, hunger, and death in it. Yeshua came to redeem where it is wrong and heal the world where it's broken. His miracles are not just proofs that he has power, but wonderful foretastes of what he's going to do with that power. Yeshua's miracles are not just a challenge to our minds, but a promise to our hearts that the world we all want is in fact coming.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.